Well, good morning. I am here to introduce, in lieu of Christine Swanson from the Office of Dietary Supplements at NIH, who unfortunately could not be here because of budget constraints at NIH currently, but she'd asked me to specifically mention that ODS is planning to develop an iodine initiative to facilitate investigator-initiated research to be funded by NIH institutes and centers, and also recently added iodine to its Analytical Methods and Reference Materials program, which is a collaboration with the National Institute of Standards. So I'm going to start by giving sort of the background for the rest of the discussion this morning. So I will sort of give background about iodine nutrition, and then we'll hear about sort of case studies both in the U.S., where we are today, and in New Zealand, which has had some interesting developments over the last decade or two. I don't have any disclosures. What I want to walk through in the next 20 minutes is dietary iodine requirements, what we need in our diet and why, and how that changes across the life cycle, how we assess iodine sufficiency of populations, and then why I would argue that we should care, what are the consequences of iodine deficiency, and something that's less of a public health problem but also an important issue, at least in subpopulations, is what goes wrong when there's too much iodine in the diet. And then I will finish and hopefully set the stage for our other two speakers by talking briefly about global iodine status in 2013. Welcome. So to start with, we get iodine in the diet. It's absorbed pretty readily across the GI tract, gets into the bloodstream, and there either one of two things can happen. It gets taken up by the thyroid and used to make thyroid hormone, and that's really its only known use in the human body, or else it circulates and is excreted by the kidneys. And ultimately, about 90% of the iodine that we ingest winds up in the urine. And in order to make adequate amounts of thyroid hormone, you need different amounts at different stages in your life. So most adults need 150 micrograms of iodine a day to maintain normal thyroid hormone production. Lower in children, it's not that it's higher in infants than in older children here, it's just that we don't have enough data about what infants require to have set RDAs in very young babies. So we don't really have good thresholds for children under 12 months. And then importantly, requirements go up substantially in both pregnancy and in lactation. So pregnant women need somewhere on the order of 220 to 250 micrograms daily, and women who are breastfeeding possibly even a bit more, 250 to 290 micrograms. Women who are pregnant need more iodine for a few reasons. One is that they increase their thyroid hormone production early in pregnancy by about 50% and just need iodine as substrate to do this. This is driven by pregnancy hormones and by estrogen. They metabolize thyroid hormone a little more rapidly due to an enzyme found in the placenta. Some iodine is transferred to the fetus, as I'll show you momentarily. And then in addition, women who are pregnant lose more iodine in the urine because it's just passively lost with filtration in the kidney, and filtration rates go up in pregnancy. So we think as much as 30 to 50% more iodine that's ingested is lost in the urine in pregnancy than it is outside pregnancy. In thinking about pregnant women, it's always sort of important to think about what crosses the placenta. So what does the mother see and what does the baby see? Thyroid hormones, T4 and T3 here, cross the placenta, but just in very small but very critical amounts. Iodine crosses freely. The fetus has a thyroid by about 10 weeks gestation, and then by about 16 or 20 weeks, that fetal thyroid is functional. So starting mid-gestation, the fetus needs iodine to make its own thyroid hormone. Before that, the maternal thyroid hormone that crosses the placenta is really very critical for normal development. And if a woman delivers and opts to breastfeed, she continues to have high iodine requirements because iodine is actively concentrated into breast milk, where it is critically important because it will be the only source of iodine nutrition for a child who's exclusively breastfed. So how do we assess iodine status? Urinary iodine is probably the most widely used measure right now. WHO, ICC-IDD, which is the International Council for the Control of Iodine Deficiency Disorders, and UNICEF have established these thresholds for median population urinary iodine concentrations so that a population with really good iodine nutrition will have a median urinary iodine concentration somewhere on the order of 100 to 200 micrograms per liter. Anything less than 100 is considered deficient. Anything more than 300 might be excessive. And in pregnancy, the thresholds shift a little bit because those pregnant women both need more iodine and they're losing more iodine in the urine. That median, optimal median value shifts up to 150 to 250 micrograms per liter. In lactating women, the cutoff is 100 micrograms per liter, same as for the general adult population, not because they need less iodine, but because some of the iodine is being lost in breast milk rather than in urine, so the urine values will reflect that. And importantly, although this works really well as a population median value, and we can assess population status very nicely with urinary iodine in individuals changes on a daily and even on an hourly basis. It's hugely variable. And so it's been estimated that to get about 10% precision to assess an individual's urinary iodine status or dietary iodine status, you would need 40 different 24-hour urine collections. I have never met a patient who would be remotely willing to do that, so this is not a practical measure. So essentially, we can assess populations, we can't assess individuals. So why does this matter? We used to think of iodine deficiency as something that caused goiter or thyroid enlargement as kind of a cosmetic problem. I think it's recognized today that there's a whole spectrum of iodine deficiency disorders, and the effects may differ at different points of the life cycle. You can see sort of the longest list of things that go wrong is when a mother is pregnant and getting inadequate iodine. So a mother who's iodine deficient in pregnancy is at higher risk for miscarriage and for stillbirth. Her child is at risk for a whole host of congenital anomalies and for both increased perinatal and infant mortality. Cretinism is a syndrome associated with the most severe iodine deficiency, and I'll show you that in a moment. Anywhere in the life cycle, iodine deficiency can cause hypothyroidism or underactive thyroid. And because of the importance of thyroid hormone for normal neurodevelopment, iodine deficiency in utero or in early life is associated with decreased neurocognitive development and is believed still in 2013 to be the leading preventable cause of impaired intellectual development. So the neurocognitive effects of iodine deficiency depend both on the severity of the iodine deficiency and the timing in gestation or in early life. But mental retardation can really result from iodine deficiency, certainly if a mother is pregnant, but probably also into early infancy and early life. And that tends to manifest specifically as both low verbal and performance IQ on different subscales. There are some studies that suggest that there may be associations not just with neurocognitive disorders, but possibly also with neurobehavioral disorders. So some observational data suggesting perhaps an association with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and some interesting data coming out of Europe recently suggesting potential associations of low thyroid function or low iodine nutrition with things like poor executive function and possibly even autism spectrum disorders. So cretinism is sort of the worst case scenario. This occurs when a pregnant woman gets less than 20 to 25 micrograms of iodine a day, so less than a tenth of what we think she really needs. And this is a very devastating syndrome in which children are born with very profound intellectual deficits, with impaired growth, with multiple neurologic abnormalities, often with deafness. And the photo shows three adult women. They're the same age as a young man standing behind them. You can see they've had this very dramatically impaired growth, some abnormal facial features, and unfortunately would also have very severe intellectual deficits. Less extreme iodine deficiency may still manifest as lower IQ. There are now two meta-analyses from China that suggest that in moderately to severely iodine deficient populations, there may be an average decrease in IQ of about 12 to 13 points, which you can imagine has not just individual ramifications, but very profound ramifications for society. And we hadn't had very much data until just recently looking at effects of milder degrees of maternal iodine deficiency and effects on child development. But there are two papers that were both published last April, which have looked at more modest iodine reductions. This is one from Sarah Bath and colleagues in the UK, who used the ALSPAC pregnancy cohort to look at maternal urinary iodine at one point in pregnancy and then child IQ at age 9. And what was sort of interesting and I think surprising to many people about this study is that even the most mild degree of iodine deficiency, here the urinary iodine concentrations 50 to 150 micrograms per gram creatinine, was associated with statistically significant decrements in IQ. There's a similar study published, as I said, at the same time earlier this year from Tasmania, suggesting again that one maternal urinary iodine concentration was associated with lower educational measures. These are on the state sort of mandated standard exams at age 9, and there were associated decreases in spelling, grammar, and reading scores. And the children whose mothers on a one-time measure had urinary iodine less than 150 micrograms per liter. So iodine deficiency is a major public health problem. Iodine excess is not. But I want to show you a few slides just to demonstrate that, as for many nutrients, there's a U-shaped relationship between iodine intake and health. Too little is not a good thing, but too much, at least for some populations, is not either. Most of us can tolerate a really large iodine load because we've got this built-in homeostatic mechanism that's been labeled the Wolff-Chaikoff effect. So that for most people, if you see a huge dose of iodine, you'll sort of transiently shut down thyroid hormone production for a day or two, and then it will resume at normal levels. There are people who are susceptible, though, to high iodine levels. Those who have grown up in parts of the world that are iodine deficient have developed goiter or thyroid enlargement, and then over time that goiter develops nodules which stop being responsive to normal feedback. So people who have nodular goiter from living in an area that's iodine deficient, if they suddenly see a large amount of iodine, may become hyperthyroid. They don't shut down thyroid hormone production appropriately. And then at the other end, people with some underlying degree of thyroid compromise, often those with thyroid autoimmunity, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, history of partial thyroid surgery, and importantly, the fetus, may develop hypothyroidism if they get too much iodine. These are some topical iodine-containing solutions that were used in large doses in a pregnant female. It's a slide from my colleague, Lou Braverman. Here's her newborn. I know how well you can see this, and I don't know if you can measure IQ in horses, but you can see this poor baby has a huge goiter, very enlarged thyroid in his neck, as a consequence of that maternal high iodine exposure. So the mother may remain with normal thyroid function, but the fetus sort of selectively can become hypothyroid in this setting. And it happens in humans, too. These are data we reported with Steve LaFranchi out in Oregon a year ago. Three infants born with neonatal hypothyroidism, underactive thyroid, which was picked up on the newborn screens, and all of them had mothers who were getting very high iodine intakes, 10 to 12 milligrams a day, so an order of magnitude too high, which had resulted in hypothyroidism in their children. So we don't have wonderful data to know how much iodine is too much. What we have are sort of anecdotal stories, like the ones I just showed you. We don't have great population measures to know where these cutoffs should be. But the Institute of Medicine has sort of set 1,100 micrograms a day as a tolerable upper limit. WHO, UNICEF, and ICC IDD have been a little more conservative for pregnancy and breastfeeding and have set that upper limit for 500 a day. And finally, where are we globally right now? Just to set the stage for the two talks that are coming, this is where we were 20 years ago. So in 1993, we didn't have a lot of urinary iodine concentration values, which are what we really rely on today. So these are countries' iodine status based on total goiter rate, so feeling for thyroid enlargement by palpation, usually in school children. And all those countries that are in some shade of gray are iodine deficient, which is actually most of the world. 110 countries considered iodine deficient at that time. Many of them in the sort of dark black here, severely iodine deficient, places where you might have seen cretinism. And only a handful of countries, really, that looked okay. 655 million people considered to be affected at that time. And in the early 1990s, there was a huge push made. The goal was actually to eliminate iodine deficiency worldwide by the year 2000, which hasn't happened. But there was a huge public health push internationally to try and remediate the situation. And salt iodization has been the primary vector for doing this worldwide, not the only one, but the main one that's been used. So salt was first iodized in the U.S. and Switzerland in the 1920s, based on work by David Marine in Ohio, who demonstrated that you could eliminate endemic goiter by supplementing people with iodine. And salt was picked as the vector for this, partially because it's consumed by everybody worldwide year-round in fairly stable amounts day-to-day for most people. Often, but not always, a fairly limited production center, so you could iodize salt at central points and then just burst it. And it's amazingly cheap. Still in 2013, 5 cents per person per year to make this happen. It does require a lot of monitoring to do this right. So once a salt iodization program is established, you need to have ongoing monitoring both of population levels and of salt iodine levels to make sure that the doses are correct. And with the current push by CDC and WHO and other organizations to decrease salt intakes worldwide to improve cardiovascular health, now there needs to be coordination of iodine dosing in salt with salt reduction programs to make sure that everything stays in balance. This is where we are in 2013, huge changes in the last two decades. The countries that are lighting up in purple here are the ones that are still considered to be iodine deficient. So 30 countries around the world. And some of these whole country numbers come from sort of smaller populations. And there's an important caveat that some, like the U.S., which you'll hear about momentarily, although considered iodine sufficient overall, may not be iodine sufficient for all populations. So finally, I'd like to just remind you that we need dietary iodine for thyroid hormone production, that requirements change across the life cycle, and pregnant and lactating women in particular both need more iodine, and their offspring are probably the ones who are most vulnerable to effects of iodine deficiency. That we can determine iodine status at the population but not at the individual patient level, which means that iodine recommendations really need to be public health level recommendations rather than individual patient level recommendations. That although it's not a major public health problem, excess iodine intake is not appropriate either because vulnerable populations may develop thyroid dysfunction. And that in spite of massive progress in the last 20 years, we still have a global public health problem with iodine deficiency.